From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today is the 112th anniversary of the birth of Marcus Garvey. We'll speak with his son about his father's history and legacy. This evening, Texas is set to execute a paranoid schizophrenic man. It'll be the 100th execution under the governorship of George Bush, the compassionate conservative. We'll hear from the condemned man's mother, Lois Robeson, who fought to have her son committed to a mental hospital, now is fighting for his life. And four apparel manufacturers agree to settle a lawsuit accusing them of allowing sweatshop conditions in Saipan. We'll talk about the grassroots movement that led to it. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Rescuers dug frantically with their bare hands today to free people trapped in the rubble of a massive earthquake that rocked western Turkey's biggest cities, killing at least 500 people and injuring thousands. The quake, measuring 7.8 on the Richter scale, struck at 3 a.m. local time, shaking people out of their beds, sending them into the streets. Many people fled their homes in nightclothes. Later, they walked through the glass-strewn streets without their shoes, with cloth wrapped around their feet. Dozens of buildings collapsed in Istanbul. Authorities recovered 40 bodies from the debris, said 500 were injured. The hardest hit area appeared to be around the industrial city of Izmit, where an oil refinery was in flames. A two-story, $3.4 billion spacecraft carrying a load of deadly plutonium will zoom within 725 miles of Earth today to gain momentum for the final leg of its meandering seven-year voyage to Saturn. Cassini's return, 2 years after NASA launched the largest and most expensive unmanned spacecraft ever, poses virtually no risk, mission officials say. But anti-nuclear activists concerned over the 72 pounds of carcinogenic cargo disagree. Bruce Gagnon of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space says the fact is space technology can and does fail. And when you start using nuclear materials in increasing numbers, the odds of an accident increase. Thousands of South African state workers stayed off the job yesterday, and unions representing 800,000 others, including nurses, teachers, and police, plan to join them next week as President Thabo Mbeki face increasing pressure to deliver a better life to South Africans. About 10,000 employees of the telecom state communications monopoly and of the post office demonstrated yesterday in Pretoria, the capital, and marched in Cape Town and other cities. Protesters threatened to bring mail and telephone services to a halt countrywide if the wage hike demands were ignored. This news from Brazil, opening a mass trial of police charged in an infamous 1996 massacre of rural workers. One of the accused officers said it was actually the workers who incited the violence. The massacre of 19 landless workers was one of the bloodiest examples of the land-related violence which plagues Brazil, where the poorest 40% population owns just 1% of the land. With 150 officers charged, the case has the largest number of defendants in Brazilian history. The Brazilian media has billed it the trial of the century. Prosecutors say police opened fire on protesters at the behest of local landowners who'd paid a police colonel nearly $85,000 to eliminate 10 leaders of the landless rural workers movement with which the protesters were aligned. The protesters were blocking a road in the southern Amazon. An attack in Kosovo has left two teenagers dead. It happened in the sector that U.S. peacekeepers patrol. NATO officials say unidentified attackers fired 9 mortar rounds into a village about 25 miles southeast of Pristina last night. A 14-year-old girl and 16-year-old boy were killed. In a separate incident, an 8-year-old ethnic Albanian boy was shot and injured in another town in the American sector. The 40,000-member NATO force has been unable to stop the cycle of ethnic violence in the region. Has been mainly perpetrated against the Serbs since the KFOR forces came in. Up to $1 billion in public funds and international aid has been stolen by Muslim, Croatian, and Serbian nationalist leaders in Bosnia, the New York Times is reporting today. According to an American-led anti-fraud unit, corruption in Bosnia is so rampant that relief agencies and embassies downplay the thefts for fear of international donors. The report, which has not been made public, cites one incident in which 10 foreign embassies and international aid agencies lost more than $20 million deposited in a Bosnian bank. Only the Swiss embassy has publicly acknowledged the loss. And 61 people were executed in western China in one day as part of a 100-day-long severe punishment drive aimed at cracking down on crime, according to state media reports. The executions held last Friday followed those of 71 people who were killed June 25th by firing squad. Among those executed, 33 people convicted of murder, 20 armed robbers, a kidnapper, 3 rapists, and 4 people convicted of assault. And finally, he's got an airport named after him, a presidential library, and soon there may be a Ronald Reagan license plate. California's moved a step closer to having license plates honoring Reagan. A state Senate panel endorsed the idea yesterday. That clears the way for a vote in the full Senate. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A Texas state court yesterday refused to grant a stay of execution to Larry Robeson, a paranoid schizophrenic on death row in Texas, who's scheduled for execution this evening at 6 local time. Robeson's lawyer, Melody Smith, had petitioned the courts for a 30-day delay to have Robeson's mental state evaluated. Robeson confessed to killing 5 people in August of 1982. His lawyers and his family have maintained he was severely mentally ill at the time, prompting calls for mercy from Pope John Paul II and from several mental health organizations. While his victims' family members have rejected the insanity argument, Robeson's family says the state refused to commit him to a hospital for treatment before the crimes, and he was released from several public hospitals before he went on a killing spree. Mental health advocates have pointed out that while Texas spends an average of $2 million in capital trials, it ranks 49th in the country for mental health spending. This would be the 100th execution for Texas Governor George Bush since he took office. Bush has not taken action in any of the 99 executions that have so far been carried out since he was sworn into office in January of 95. Texas may break its own record of executions this month. 6 have been scheduled for August, and 3 of them have already been carried out, including that of a mentally retarded man. Yesterday, we began to talk about the case of Larry Robeson. Today, we'll continue the conversation with his mother, Lois Robeson, who for the past 18 years has been fighting for his son's life. She joins us now from Huntsville, Texas, where she is about to enter the prison for a visit with her son, which may be the last one. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Lois Robeson.
Thank you.
Can you tell us where you are right now?
Well, we're at a motel room in Huntsville because we thought the reception would be better, and we'll leave immediately after we talk to go see him. Other family members are there visiting him now, including his daughter.
Tell us about your son's case. What happened, what the killing spree involved, what you tried to do before the murders were committed, and what you've done since.
Do you want me to tell you what happened before first?
Yes, go ahead. Start with before.
Okay. Larry was a wonderful little boy who never had any problems until he was about 12 years old. But then he began to have problems. We took him to a family counseling center where they didn't find out why, you know, he was having problems with. Then we took him to the Kansas University Medical Center psychiatric department where he was in outpatient treatment when he was 15. they still didn't give him a diagnosis. They helped us to deal with his bizarre behavior. We didn't know about the family history at that time, or we might have recognized that it was paranoid schizophrenia. He wasn't actually diagnosed until after he was in the Air Force. He signed up for 4 years in the Air Force, and they sent him home in 1 year. He was overseas in Amsterdam, Holland, and after 1 year, they sent him home with an honorable discharge with no explanation of why. We found out later that that was where he actually had his first break. He came home by making some very strange statements, sleeping under a pyramid, thinking he could move things with his mind, thinking other people could read his thoughts and so forth. We didn't recognize this as a mental illness. We thought he'd been reading some books about the occult, and he just was going through a phase of experimenting with that sort of thing. We kept trying to get him help through the Mental Health Mental Retardation Center. We kept, through our church, through the Pastoral Care Center at our church. It was when he had just turned 21. He called me up one night and he said, Mom, he was crying, and he said, Mom, please help me. I know what's wrong. Now I've been flying out of my body over Camp Blue Boulevard, singing the story of my life lit up like a neon sign. Has it been on television? And I said, no, it's not been on television, honey. And he said, well, it's a conspiracy. The CIA and the Air Force are trying to keep this secret. And he asked us to please come get him and help him. So we did. We called the hospital because by then we recognized that this was paranoia. We told them we were coming. And so we went to get him. And his roommates were very glad for him to leave because they were scared to death. On the way to the hospital, he told us that he started crying and said he killed some people because he blew up the power came out of the middle of his forehead and blew up his car that was waiting for gas at a gas station, and the people died. Well, we knew, of course, that this was a delusion. We knew that this was not real, that he had not really done that. But he was crying and says, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to do it, I couldn't help it. He voluntarily went to the hospital. He said yes, he wanted to talk to the family doctor to see what was wrong. We got him in to see the emergency room specialist, who examined him and then came out and told us that Larry was paranoid schizophrenic, very serious. They needed to admit him to the hospital. They called our family doctor. He arranged to have him admitted. Then he called in a private psychiatrist, Dr. Arauzo, who worked there at Hughley, and they examined him and called us in and talked to us, and they said Larry is very, very seriously ill. He's paranoid schizophrenic. We had thought that some of his problems were caused by taking drugs because we did know that he had experimented with drugs like most kids his age did. We thought that that caused his paranoia. They said no, it wasn't the drugs that did it. The paranoia, the illness came first. The drugs may have made it worse, but the illness was already there. It was not caused by drugs. And so they wanted to commit him to long-term treatment. They said he needed very long-term treatment. And who was our insurance with? We told him that our insurance was Blue Cross Blue Shield, but Larry wasn't covered because he just had his 21st birthday and that he didn't have insurance on his job, so he had no insurance at all. When they found this out, they discharged him. And they told us to take him to the county hospital. They discussed sending him to the state hospital, which was where he needed to be, but they decided it would be easier to send him to the county hospital. So we took him to the county hospital. We sat there for 7 hours trying to get him admitted, and they wouldn't admit him because he said he wasn't showing overt symptoms. And when I told them I was trying to keep him calm and I could get overt symptoms if that's what they wanted, they did change their minds and they locked him up. After we got to the public facilities, they would no longer even tell us the diagnosis. They would not tell us what we should do when he had delusions or when he was afraid or when he thought people were trying to kill him. We asked, and they said, because of the privacy law, we cannot tell you anything about his case because he's over 21. So they kept him in the hospital there. They medicated him to the state of being a zombie because back then all they had was Haldol and Thorazine, which were simply chemical restraints. They kept him on the locked ward for 3 days, and then they put him on the open ward where he could walk out any time he wanted to. And I argued with them that, you know, they they couldn't do this. And they said, we have to. We need the bed for somebody worse. And then they called me up in 30 days, and they wouldn't tell us anything about how to deal with his situation or even what was wrong. But anyway, they called us and said, we're discharging Larry. And they told us not to take him home. And we said, why? And they wouldn't tell us. And I said, well, you can't, you know, he has nothing. He has no job. He has no money. He has no car. He has no place to stay. He has nobody but us. You can't just put him out on the street. And they said to us, you'd be surprised. We do it every day. There's a lot of schizophrenics out on the street, and most of them cope fairly well. I begged, I pleaded, I cried. I even got a little angry, and I tried to get them to keep him. They wouldn't do it. I called the family doctor. He said he couldn't do it. Call a psychiatrist. I called the psychiatrist. He said that he couldn't tell John Peter Smith County Hospital what to do. I called every mental hospital in Texas, starting with Austin and Wichita Falls and Ruskin, everybody, trying to get him committed. Nobody would do it because they said he's never been violent. That was why John Peter Smith told us they couldn't keep him, because he wasn't violent. He had never done anything violent. He had never made any threats to anybody. And they said, we cannot keep him more than 30 days unless he is a threat to himself or to other people. And he has never shown any signs of being a threat. So they absolutely wouldn't keep him longer than 30 days. None of the hospitals would take him. So finally, I just racked my brain for something we could do. And I said, he's a veteran. Can we get him in the veteran hospital? And they said, oh, we might do that. So they did make the arrangements to get him in the veterans hospital in Waco. And they said we would have to take him and talk himself into voluntarily committing himself, because they couldn't commit him because he wasn't violent. So we took him to Waco, to the veterans hospital, and persuaded him to sign himself in voluntarily, which was not easy to do because paranoid schizophrenics think you're trying to kill them, and they're trying to hurt them. So, but he loved us enough that he did what we said, and he signed himself in. They would not answer any questions for us either because of the Privacy Act. They asked us everything, and they told us nothing. They wouldn't tell us what to do when he had the delusions. They wouldn't tell us what to do when he was frightened and thought people were trying to kill him. They wouldn't tell us anything because of the Privacy Act. They wouldn't even tell us the diagnosis if we didn't already have it. We would have never known it. They kept him for 30 days. And actually, once he ran away and got to a house in the neighborhood and called me and said he was going to commit suicide if I didn't come and get him. Bless the woman's heart, whose house he stopped at. She kept him in her house until I could call the hospital to go get him and take him back. And, you know, they told me they couldn't do it. Because he was on voluntary commitment, he wanted to leave, he could leave. I persuaded Larry to go back, but it took me longer to persuade the hospital to go get him. But they finally said they would if he wouldn't resist, and so they took him back and kept him another 2 weeks. They called me up one day, and they had told us not to take him home, just like the others did, not to take him home. They wouldn't tell us why. But then they called me and said, we're sending Larry to Burleson on the bus. He will be there at 11 o'clock. And I said, is he well? And they said, no, he's not well, and he'll get worse if he doesn't get treatment. But we can't keep him any longer than 30 days on a voluntary commitment, and we can't do an involuntary commitment because he is not a danger to himself or to society. But he will get worse if he doesn't get treatment. And I said, then what are we supposed to do? And they told me, that Dr. Rowe told me, take him to the Mental Health Mental Retardation Center in Fort Worth, and they will give him outpatient treatment, and they will give him his medication. And I said, okay, we'll do that. I immediately called for an appointment. The first one I could get was like 2 weeks down the road for an intake interview. An hour later, Dr. Rowe called me again, and he said, we made a small mistake. We forgot to have Larry sign his release of records. And so you will have to take him to the MHMR office and have them get him to sign a release of records. They will send it to us, and then we will send them his records, and then they can treat him and give him his medication. I said, okay, I'll do that.
Lois Robeson, we're going to have to break for stations to identify themselves, but when we come back, you can finish up this description of what happened to Larry Robeson before He committed the murders, and then what has happened since? Again, we're speaking with Lois Robeson, mother of Larry, who is set to die today at 6 o'clock Texas time, unless the governor of Texas, Governor George W. Bush, decides to stay that execution. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. We're joined by Lois Robeson, who is the mother of Larry Robeson, who for the past 18 years has been on death row and is slated to be executed tonight. It will be the 100th execution of George W. Bush, or under George W. Bush's reign, since he was sworn into office in 1995. Lois Robeson, continue with the story. This is just before the killings.
I just want to make one correction. He's been on death row 16 years.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. All right. I took him to the mental retardation. They did an intake interview. It took us 3 weeks to get an appointment with a nurse, and that was when they got the release of records signed. They said they didn't have any appointments any sooner because they were underfunded and understaffed. They had given us enough medication to last about a week or so. The medication ran out, and Larry began to get worse and worse and worse. We went to see the nurse, and he was already going downhill very badly, but they still couldn't give him the medication until they got his records. It took at least 3 more weeks before they got the records and he could get an appointment with the doctor. By that time, he had left home. He had disappeared. He borrowed his sister's car. He wrecked it in Weatherford, Texas, a few miles west of us. He went to a car rental place to rent a truck. And in his psychotic state, he decided he would try out the truck by driving it around the block to see if it was good, and it had the keys in it, so he did. They chased him down the street, and they stopped him, and they said, "You can't take this truck." And he said, "I was just going to try it out." And they arrested him and charged him with felony theft of a truck. They put him in jail. It was about 2 days before we found out where he was when we reported our daughter's car missing, and they located him and found out he was in jail there. We left him in jail without bail because we could not get him into a mental hospital or keep him, and we felt like he was safer in a small town jail than he would be wandering around out on the streets, and we just didn't have any way of keeping him in a safe place. So we let him stay there for 6 months. I went to see his court-appointed attorney, explained everything to him about Larry's record. He told me to go to the DA. I went to the DA, and he told me to go to the judge. I went to Judge Harry Hopkins, who's now on one of the high courts in Texas, but he was on the court in Weatherford then, and he was nice enough to take me into his office, and I told him all about Larry's medical history all the way back, and I said, "Please, please, please commit him for the long-term treatment that everybody says he needs." And he says, "Has he ever been violent?" And I said, "No, Larry has never been violent in his whole life." And he says, "I'm sorry, I don't have the power to commit him unless he's been violent. And he will probably have to go to prison for this charge." I sat there with tears in my eyes, and I begged him again to please commit him, and he said, "I don't have the power." I went back home. I went through the Blue Book in Texas. It has all the helping agencies. It was for Tarrant County. And I called every one of them that I thought could possibly have anything to do with young people, with drugs, with mental illness, with rehabilitation, with anything. I called them all. No one would listen to me until I got down to the next to the last page, Volunteers of America. And a man named Joe Bell, who lived in our hometown, listened to me, heard Larry's story, and he said, I think I can help you. Larry was scheduled to be tried the next day. He went over there, and he arranged for a plea bargain. And if Larry would sign a plea bargain that he stole a wheel or a headlight or something off the truck, and they let him out for time served. Larry was very upset about it because he said, Mom, I didn't want to lie. They made me lie. I didn't steal anything. I didn't steal the truck, and I certainly didn't steal a headlight. And I said, it's okay, honey. That's the way they do these things. So they put him in a halfway house at the Volunteers of America in Fort Worth on Hempel Street. And there they thought his problem was drugs, and they treated him as though he was a drug addict. He still didn't get any medication. He still didn't get any treatment for his mental illness. We still didn't really understand about it because none of the doctors would explain to us about it. So he stayed there for over a year. He was able to go out and work days and come back there nights. And once I think he didn't come back on time, and they pulled his probation and sent him back to jail. But then they took him back in again, and he stayed there for quite a while. While he was there and working on the outside, he met Tina, and they were together, and they had a baby, Melissa. We saw him occasionally when he came to the house. He seemed to be a little better. We weren't around him for very long at a time. I thought his wife knew about his mental illness. I found out since that she did not know. And we didn't know. We thought a miracle had happened, and Larry was better, because nobody still had told us how we were to deal with this illness. When Melissa was about 6 months old, Larry began to have really strange and bizarre behavior again. He began to really go downhill, and his wife became frightened. She took the baby, and she went back to her parents in Kansas City. When she left, Larry just went downhill immediately, became extremely depressed, and just beginning to have very bizarre behavior. I think he even got arrested once. He was only in jail like a day or two, and they turned him loose. But he decided that he would go to Kansas to be near his wife, and he went and stayed with a friend that we had known when he was growing up in Kansas City. And he tried to get a job there. His wife decided that she would come back, and they were going to get back together. He couldn't get a job in Kansas. So he decided that he would come back to Texas and get a job. His wife gave notice on her job, and his sister, Vicki, was there to bring back one of her children who was visiting her father on visitation, you know, custody visitation. And so Larry asked her if he could ride back to Texas with her. He had gotten a letter from Ricky Bryant inviting him to stay at his house until he could find a place for himself and his wife and child. And so he agreed to do that. He had met Ricky previously when he lived in Texas. So Vicki took him back. She dropped him off at Ricky's house. And it was, I believe, it was just a few days later, I guess, that he came to Vicki's house. And he stayed all day sitting there with his head in his hands and very, very depressed. And he had been trying to find a job and couldn't, but he wouldn't tell her why he was there. He just sat there all day. He later told her that he had come to kill her and her daughter. He had the gun in his pocket. He said that the voices were telling him he had to do it. We just learned that, you know, later. He stayed there all day. And she said she wished she pulled out the gun because she was sure she could have talked him out of it and we could have got him help, because that would have been threatening behavior. He said when he left her house, he said he was coming to our house. He never did show up. Vicki called me to ask if Larry got to our house, and I said, no, we haven't seen him or heard from him. And she said, well, he said he was coming to your house. That was an hour ago. So she gave me the phone number he had given her at the phone number at Ricky's house. So I called the number, and Ricky Brown answered the telephone. And he was very friendly. And I said, is Larry there? And he said, yes. And I said, could I speak to him? He said, sure. And he put Larry on the phone, and I said, Larry, Vicky said you were coming to see us, but you didn't come. Why didn't you come? And he said, Mom, I just couldn't. I just couldn't. I just couldn't. And I said, well, why don't you just come now? You know, we want to see you. Come on now. He said, I can't, Mom. I can't. I just can't. I just can't. And so I said, okay, will you come for your birthday, which was about 3 days later? And he said, yes. And his voice was very flat and very strange. And I said, what do you want for your birthday? And he says, I don't need anything, Mom. And I thought that was very strange coming from a man who was only had the clothes on his back. He had even lost his tools, I believe, that he was a sheetrock hanger in construction. So we made plans. He didn't do much talking. He was just very, his voice was very flat and very strange. And he sounded very depressed. And I said, well, we will see you then. I believe it was Thursday that was his birthday. And I said, all the family will get together and we'll have a birthday party. The next day, I woke up to see the headlines about the horrible, horrible, horrendous murders at Lake Worth. It was all over the front page. I absolutely made no connection. I didn't know what the place looked like where he lived. I just said, oh, another horrible, horrendous crime. But I was getting ready to start my first year of teaching. I got my degree when I was 49, and I was just got a contract to teach third grade. And I had to go to the teacher supply house to get supplies for my classroom. So I took our youngest daughter, and I went out, and I went to the teacher supply houses buying posters and things for the classroom. Later on that day, I was to meet Ken at the Pastoral Care Center at Bright Divinity University at TCU, where we had been going for years for asking for help for Larry and trying to deal and cope with all this. And it had been told over and over, don't be a mother hen. He's 21. He's not your responsibility. And I said, today, they're going to have to help us help Larry. And 3 blocks before I got to the Pastoral Care Center, I heard on the radio, the first thing I heard was Larry Keith Robinson. And I heard something about extradited from Kansas. I had not paid any attention to the news until I heard his name. I was just, you know, thinking about driving. And I thought, that's very strange. You know, Larry Keith Robinson in Kansas. It can't be our Larry. He's here in Fort Worth. But it puzzled me. I thought, can there be another Larry Keith Robinson? So, you know, just very shortly after, I pulled up into the parking lot and met my husband, Ken. And he got out of the car, and we were walking into the Pastoral Care Center, and I said, honey, I heard the strangest thing on the radio. They said a Larry Keith Robinson had been extradited from Kansas. And Ken stumbled and fell, and he started saying, oh, no, oh, no, oh, no, oh, no. And I said, what's the matter? What's the matter? And he said, oh, I don't want to tell you. I don't want to tell you. And I said, well, you know, you have to tell me what happened. What happened? He said, oh, honey, that's that horrible, horrible murder where 5 people were killed out there at Lake Worth. And we were both just totally stunned and devastated, but we kept hoping, this is not our Larry, this is not our Larry, this has to be another Larry. Our Larry couldn't do anything like that. So we went in to see the psychiatrist. He came out to see us, and immediately we told him what we had heard. He turned as white as a sheet and said, can you call somebody? So we called our house, and our daughter Vicky was there, and as soon as she heard my voice, she says, oh, Mom, where have you been? We've been trying to find you all day. The reporters are calling. Everybody's calling. Where have you been? And I knew immediately it was our Larry that was involved in this. And we were just absolutely horrified. You cannot imagine how horrible it was to know that a member of your family was involved in something as gruesome. And it was the most horrible murder that I ever heard of in my life. It was just so devastating to us. And our first thoughts were for the victims and their families. And I thought, oh, this is so horrible. This is so horrible. How could somebody that we know and love, you know, be involved in anything this bad? We still kept hoping that maybe he didn't really have anything to do with it. My second thought was, oh, my God, I knew he was sick, but I didn't know he was that sick. But we had been told repeatedly that if Larry ever got violent, that they would commit him for long-term treatment. So I fully expected, all our family fully expected, that knowing that Larry had this long history of mental illness with diagnosis by three different hospitals and a lot of different doctors, that he would be sent to a mental hospital for life.
We're talking to Lois Robeson, who is the mother of Larry Robeson, who is set to be executed tonight, 6 o'clock, Texas time, the 100th execution under Texas Governor George W. Bush, as he recounts, as Lois Robeson recounts, her son's mental illness that led to the killing of five people in the August of 1982. Lois Robeson, we only have a few more minutes, and it's many years later. With this history of mental illness, how did your son end up on death row? First of all, did the lawyer plead insanity at the trial?
Yes, they did, but he had very inexperienced lawyers, and they made mistakes. I asked him, do we need his medical records? And they said, no, we don't need his medical records. We need witnesses. An aunt came to testify that there was a history of mental illness, which my first husband's family, Larry's actual father, died when he was 2 of a malignant brain tumor. They had been hiding this for years and years and years, so we had no way of knowing that. And her husband, Larry's uncle, Larry's great-uncle, and Larry's great-grandfather were all paranoid schizophrenic. The judge heard this evidence, but the DA objected to it, and so the jury never did get to hear that evidence. There's a lot of evidence that every time I tried to tell anything, like I told you today, they told me that I was not answering their question. They only wanted yeses and nos, so the jury never did get to hear everything. They wouldn't allow Larry to testify, which he wanted to do. He wanted to plead guilty and just, you know, plead insane, and the lawyers wouldn't let him do it. They wouldn't let him testify. We couldn't get in the evidence of the family history.
He did not plead guilty?
They pleaded him not guilty, and then also not guilty by reason of insanity, which is ridiculous. If you plead insanity, you've pleaded guilty. So why say not guilty? You know, the appeals lawyer has said that they made all kinds of mistakes because they were inexperienced. And in both trials, they were inexperienced. By the time of the second trial, we knew about the family history. We didn't even know it in the first one. After the second trial, his youngest daughter, our youngest daughter, his sister, was diagnosed as manic depressive and schizophrenic. And then I found out that I had a cousin who has three mentally ill children and another cousin has one who has problems. And I found out that my mother's brother was in a mental hospital. We had been told he was in an insane asylum. PB sanitarium, but he was actually in the mental hospital. All the people keeping secrets and the family kept us from knowing what this illness might have been, or Larry would have got the help he needed in time.
Lois Robeson, today you only have a few hours with your son if he's executed, and the only chance of him not being executed is the governor, George Bush. Have you gotten a chance to talk to him, and what are the grounds in which he could prevent this from happening?
Okay. Larry's lawyer, Melody Smith, has gone to the prosecutors and told them that if they will agree to a commutation, Larry will plead guilty to all five murders in exchange for five consecutive life sentences, which would mean he would never, ever be outside of a prison again. All of the DAs said absolutely not. Greg Pipes said no. George Bush could give him a commutation. The lawyer has been trying to get forensic evaluation, a neuropsychologist. We just didn't have the time to get it done. We're asking for 30 days in order to get some more testing done because the psychiatrist who examined him and examined all his records says that he is still mentally ill and that he probably has organic brain damage because he had four head injuries. The first one, he is a year old, and on up through his teenage years, he had four head injuries. He was hit by a car and several things. And
when you see Larry today, will you be able to touch him, be near him?
No, we have never been able to touch Larry except when he was in his second trial. The judge allowed us, my husband and myself, a few minutes and his wife, but the rest of the family has not been able to touch Larry for 17 years. We've asked for a contact visit. The prison refuses to give us a contact visit. Most other states do allow contact visits for death row inmates, but Texas does not. They won't even let us touch the glass anymore. They say we're leaving fingerprints. They won't let his whole family come to see him, only his brothers and sisters, myself and my husband, his wife and his daughter. None of his other relatives can see him, his cousins, his nieces and nephews, who haven't seen him since they reached the age of 12.
Lois Robeson,
on his list.
Do you have Governor Bush's phone number?
Yes, I do. It's area code 512-463-2000.
That's 512-463-2000, Governor Bush is his last chance. We have 30 seconds, and I'm pained to ask you how you feel today as a mother, but certainly hearing your story, you have done everything in your power over these last 16 years.
I know I've done that. We have a web page for Larry. It's governor.state.tx.usa if people want to email. My daughter can tell you, she's put up a web page with all this information on it, www.geocities.com/Athens with a capital A, Pantheon with a capital P, /6765/index.html.
Lois Robeson, I want to thank you for being with us, and we will put that out on our website at www.pacifica.org as you head now into the prison to see your son, Larry Robeson. Thank you for being with us.
Please give him the 30-day stay so that we can get the rest of this testing done.
Thanks for being with us from Huntsville, Texas. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Well, there was day and there was night, and there was dark and there was light. There was the earth, there was the sky, and there in the tree they crawled alive.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, it is August 17th, and on August 17th, 1887, 112 years ago, Marcus Garvey was born. Marcus Garvey might be a name many of you know, many of you may know his history, but also many people may not be familiar with his significance, only having heard his name. Well, Marcus Garvey founded and led the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League, usually called the UNIAACL. It's the largest mass movement in African American history. It flourished from 1919 to the mid-1920s, existed in almost 40 states domestically and over 40 countries internationally, and is alive today. Estimates of its membership range from 1 to 11 million people worldwide, making it the largest Pan-African movement of all time. But Marcus Garvey did not just establish that. He also established the Negro World, which is a weekly, soon to become the most widely circulated African newspaper in the world after its publication in 1918. The Black Star Line Steamship Corporation, which was intended to provide employment for many African seamen, dignified accommodation for African travelers, and a vehicle for Pan-African trade and emigration. But today, rather than me go through his history on this 112th anniversary of Marcus Garvey's birth, we're joined by Marcus Garvey's son, Marcus Garvey Jr., Marcus Garvey Jr., who himself is the president of the UNIAACL, the United Negro Improvement Association, and African Communities League. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. I'm very glad to be on the program today and to have this opportunity to speak to such a wide audience as you have.
Well, it's great to have you. And I thought it would just be interesting if you gave us a comprehensive history of your father. Of course, comprehensive is limited in 15 minutes, but to talk about where he was born, how he got started, and also in talking about all of the significant organizations and activities he was involved with, organizing he was involved with, to also talk about the response from the U.S. government and his ultimate deportation. But why don't we begin with his birth, the birth of Marcus Garvey.
Marcus Garvey was born in St. Anne's Bay, Jamaica. St. Anne's Bay was on the north coast of Jamaica in Support on August the 17th, 1887. And I want to start right away by letting you know that he was one of 11 children born to Marcus and Sarah Garvey. And only two of those children survived to adulthood, Marcus and his sister Indiana. And these were very harsh times for African people throughout the world. And health facilities were very poor.
That's right, Amy.
And,
please call and support
there
us.
There were all kinds of epidemics and
we just have
plagues that
she was telling
affected
me,
Africans
that,
as well as other people at
she
the
was
time
on a couple of national
in the Caribbean
shows
and elsewhere.
I think
he
only
was schooled in St. Anne's Bay,
and she came on Democracy Now! For 40 minutes and gave us her whole story.
He was apprenticed to his
godfather,
which
is very important in
Mr.
the context
Burroughs,
of trying to understand
to learn the printing trade,
what mental illnesses, what it can lead to,
old,
and how states neglect people
from 14 years old
up until
onwards,
the point
when they commit apprenticeship when he was 16.
And then they spend
and
sometimes
then he went on
millions of dollars
to the capital city of Kingston. Marcus Garvey, if you want to know about him, you have to understand the things that were happening around him as he was growing up. We have to understand that Marcus Garvey grew up at a time when slavery was still in existence. For instance, although the slaves had been freed in the Caribbean, in the English-speaking Caribbean in 1834, and by the French in 1848, that Puerto Rico, slavery had not been abolished until 1873. So Cuba was 1880. Now, Marcus Garvey, born in 1887, there were still slaves because slavery was not abolished in Brazil until 1888, 1 year after he was born. The result is that Marcus Garvey grew up at a time when there were many adult people around who had actually been slaves. And this was something that was formative in his mind. Also, we in Jamaica, where Marcus Garvey was born, are very close to Haiti, where the Great Revolution of 1791 to 1804 took place. If you read any of the writings of Marcus Garvey, he continually refers to this Haitian Revolution as something that affected him, and that was very important, the fact that the black people of Haiti, the Africans of Haiti, would defeat some of the finest soldiers of the great emperor, Napoleon Bonaparte. Now, also, 1885 was the date of the Congress of Berlin, and that was when Europe partitioned Africa just as if they were slicing a cake. Now, this is background of us. So you see, it's 2 years before he was born. What it means is that his father, who read Ridley, and the other people who understood, messages were carried through a seaport town as to what had happened at Berlin. So that as he was growing up, he would know these things, and he was told these things. Then in 1896, there was a very formative thing that happened, which was important and is never usually in the history books. This was the Battle of Adwa, when the Ethiopians, and at that time they were called Abyssinians, under their emperor Menelik, defeated the Italians. This was the first time that a large-scale modern European army had been defeated in the field. And there were over 40,000 Italian dead. And this is something that was kept out of the history books because, although I did European history, you know, that's the sort of history that we learned in school in Jamaica under our slave masters, our rulers, the British. We never heard of Adwa. We never heard of any defeat by Europeans. And right following this, also something happened, was the Russo-Japanese War, when for the first time non-Europeans had a naval victory against Europeans at, of course, the Battle of Tsushima Straits. This was 1905. Now, Marcus Garvey was now 18 years old, but he certainly knew about that, and of course, the Battle of Mukden. And in his writings, he refers to all of these things as telling him that we have to have science and technology. You'll find that emphasis coming in his work. Of all black leaders, none other has emphasized the importance of science and technology to race building and liberation of African people. Marcus Garvey went on, and he studied, and he went to England, worked and studied in England between the period of 1912-13. And here again, he was influenced by people he met, mainly people from Africa. This was the first time that he was meeting at first hand people from the mother continent. And it was significant that after his return from England, it was in 1914 that he formed the UNIA and ACL in Jamaica. This is a background that tells us, you know, where Marcus Garvey was coming from and some of the influences on his mind.
We're talking to Marcus.
Will give us a starting point to understand why this man became such a nationalist and why he could sympathize with nationalism exhibited by other people. And this is something about Marcus Garvey also that's not known. From here on, after 1914, he tried to build the UNIA in Jamaica, and he was not getting the, the progress that he thought he should in developing the organ. Remember, at this time, Jamaica was a colony, so that the British were in total control. And, of course, it's obviously very difficult. So he wanted to start an institute in Jamaica on the lines of Tuskegee Institute. That means which would give training to young black men and women to develop skills. He always saw the need for us to develop skills, and he appreciated the work that Booker T was doing. So he came to the United States to see Booker T. Washington. But Booker T. unfortunately died before he got here, so that when he got here, eventually, he had to deal with other people who were not sympathetic to exporting help to him to achieve the same thing in Jamaica as Booker T. had. Booker T. Washington had a much wider outlook than most African Americans understand as to the importance of black people all over the world working together to improve themselves. So this led him to eventually stay in the United States and to begin the building of this movement, which became so huge and which affected the life of Africans all over the world.
Marcus Garvey, Jr., tell us about Marcus Garvey's establishment of the Black Star Line.
Well, the Black Star Line was incorporated in Delaware in 1919. And we have to make quite clear that the Black Star Line was not intended at its beginning, its inception, to be a passenger line. It was It was to carry trade between Africans in the Caribbean and Central and South America and the United States. And that was what it was, and to help the development of that. Now, subsequently, of course, the plan was to be able to move across the ocean to Africa and to be able to be a full-scale passenger line plus a commercial line, a trade line carrying trade goods. But also, Marcus Garvey created a Negro Factories Corporation in 1920, and this was the business arm, the actual commercial arm of the movement, which had laundries, restaurants, millinery stores, grocery stores, hotels, tailor shops, doll factories. For instance, they made the first black dolls for black children to play with, printing presses, clothing factories, and other activities. Of course, the publication of the Negro World, which was the first paper that was actually put out in English, Spanish, and French, because those were the main languages that Marcus, the members of the Garvey movement, spoke.
But ultimately, Marcus Garvey was forced out of the United States. Can you explain why?
Well, he was forced out of the United States because he had such a large following of people who were outside of the political system of the United States. As simple as that. He was a thorn in the flesh these people marched to their own tune. They were creating their own businesses. Everything was done by themselves. So that it was a total self-reliance. They had plans that they were using lands in the south to produce food and bring it up here and market it in the north. All of that was going on under the Garvey movement. So also, he was introducing this into Africa. They were what people don't seem to understand is that after 1922, even while there was this pressure on him and there was some restriction in his membership, the membership of the movement increased outside of the United States. And as we said, the problems that they had because he had made these contracts to get the rubber lands in Liberia, it was necessary to stop him. And to stop him, you had to get him out of the way, and then you had to get him out of the United States because that was his principal power base.
And who was it who pushed him out of the United States?
Well, the great architect of that was the man who was up in the forefront of it was J. Edgar Hoover. And it's very important for people to realize that J. Edgar Hoover has been going after black leaders for a very, very long time. As a matter of fact, it was his lifetime avocation. And all that has happened vindicates the correct application of Marcus Garvey to nation building, that we must have economic power. We must have our own political machinery from which we can join or associate with any people in any place who we have at a certain instant in time have a common goal or objective. But we must control our own our political organizations as well as our own economic organizations.
Is it accurate to refer to Marcus Garvey as the original black nationalist and father of the Back to Africa movement?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. You see, His nationalism was totally, unreservedly black and African. So, you know, the whole objectives are, we can just briefly state some of the things that, he made, the points that he made. And I think that's a good way for me to close things. Marcus Garvey said, a race without authority and power is a race without respect. Up you mighty race, you can accomplish what you will. The only protection against injustice in man is power, physical, financial, and scientific. And finally, all of us may not live to see the higher accomplishment of an African empire so strong and powerful as to compel the respect of mankind, but we, in our lifetime, can so work and act as to make the dream a possibility within another generation.
Well, I want to thank you, Marcus Garvey Jr., very much for being with us on this 112th anniversary of the birth of your father, August 17th, 1887, Marcus Garvey, founder of the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League. If people want to get in touch with the organization that you now are president of, where can they call?
Area code 718-638-5197.
Marcus Garvey Jr., thank you for joining us. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, 1-800-735-0230 is the number to call. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Bernard White is our engineer, our technical director, Errol Maitland. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, broadcast from the studios of WBAI in New York.